This show is supported by State Farm. You have insurance for your home, your health, and your car. Why don't you have insurance for your small business? So many small business owners think they don't need or don't even know about small business insurance. Protecting a source of revenue is one thing, but so is protecting all of your hard work and your team members. State Farm agents are all small business owners too, so they know how to help small business owners choose personalized policies that fit their budgets. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
A science story, huh?
Is NYU a scientist?
I felt it.
It was that golden moment.
Because science was on my side.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to The Story Collider, where we bring you true personal stories about science. I'm your host, Misha Gajewski, and this week we have our second episode sponsored by the Carl R. Woese Institute for Genomic Biology, or IGB for short. Both our storytellers in today's episode are members of the Cutting Edge Research Institute located in the Midwest at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. As you may recall, IGB is really unique because rather than individual scientists working on their own, the IGB combines people from different scientific backgrounds to work in larger teams to tackle some of our most complex and pressing problems, such as the global food shortage or the treatment of cancer. Within the labs at the IGB, it's common to see a geologist working side by side with a physicist or a civil engineer collaborating with a plant biologist in what's come to be known as team science. These individuals unite under the umbrella of genomic research. They research everything genomic influenced, from drug discovery, diet and nutrition, personalized technology, exercise, family dynamics, even how your environment affects your mood, productivity, and health. Also uniting our storytellers is the common theme of plants and how they can be the source of great joy, frustration, inspiration, and procrastination. It's amazing how much impact plants had on our storytellers' lives. Our first story is from Anthony DeGrotto. It was recorded in his home in the fall this year.
So when I was doing my PhD in Belgium, I got to spend a lot of time in the grassland. And this is because I was working on the team with different partners, and we were interested in the impact of the climate on this grassland vegetation. And so because I was the plant physiologist in the team, I was the one going there and dealing with the plants. And twice a week, I was going there to monitor the vegetation intakes measurements. And my typical field day started at 8. And as soon as I arrived there, I need to hit the ground running because I have to take 100 measurements every 2 hours. And so I have to go there, get rid of the cows that are grazing there because they're in permanence, dozens of cows in my plot. Then I need to select 100 plants and get them ready for the measurements by putting them in the dark with a little cloth pin. And then I have to go over all of those 100 plants and measure them with the instrument in order to get something that's called chlorophyll fluorescence, which is a weak light that's emitted by plants. And I can give you information about how healthy the plant is. And then once I'm done with measuring those 100 plants, I need to repeat this process again because that's something they have to do every 2 hours. And I just spend my day circling around this field in a succession of selecting plants, measuring them, selecting plants, measuring them. And this is something that I do at 11, 1, 3, and 5, which makes a lot of squats in a day because those are grass, they're on the ground. So each time I have to get on my knees to put those cloth pin on them, which made me like rainy days because I didn't have to go in the field in those occasions. And so when I'm not in the grassland, when I'm not in the field taking measurements, I'm in the lab either organizing my data or coding on my computer or trying to learn as much as I can about chlorophyll fluorescence because it turns out that it's not an easy thing to analyze. There's still a lot of debates in the scientific community about the meaning of some tiny variation in this emission of light. And because this was the first time we were doing this kind of measurement on campus and at the lab, this was something that I had to learn by myself. And this was an expertise that I had to develop by myself. And I remember days where I was just spending hours trying to understand the difference between two different variables, just to find out later that this was actually the exact same thing, but under a different name, and sometimes calculated a little bit differently, which makes you feel quite dumb, honestly. But despite of that, when people wanted to learn about fluorescence, were interested to know if this was something they could use in their own research, they would come to me and ask for advice and what I could teach them about that. And so on those occasions, I would quickly put up a quick introduction on the subject, and then we would look at data together, see how to analyze them, what you can learn from them. And then often we would go where the experimentation was taking place and just look at the plants together, the setup, and see what could be done, what was the best approach, the best way to measure those plants. And yeah, that was a really, really fun thing to do, collaborating with other PhD students. That was great. Also because I was feeling a bit helpful. That was nice to have other people interested in what I was doing. And yeah, collaborating is always a lot of fun. And it was not only PhD students who were interested in what I was doing. I still remember by the end of my PhD thesis, I was invited at a strategic meeting with other faculty members. Because they were trying to put up a new project on campus. I was using a new facility that was being built. And I was the only PhD student at the table, which made me very proud because there was all those brilliant minds really interested in what I had to say. They were eager to learn about what I was doing, and they were asking how that could be used in the new project that they were putting up, and to be recognized as an expert at something that they'd put so much work on, so much effort. That was kind of intoxicating somehow. I was probably a little bit full of myself by the end, I have to admit. But I was very proud of that. And so fast forward dozens of meetings, thousands of lines of codes and hundreds of papers, 16,500 measurements in the field. Here I am at the lab in front of my computer. It's the end of my PhD thesis, and I'm staring at this document. That's what is going to be my first research paper, something I've been working months on. And this is everything I've ever launched for, my first publication. I've put in it everything I've learned in this grassland. This is the very reason I've been doing the sheepdog with those cows in the field those past few years. And I'm frozen because here in that lab with no cows around, no presentation to make, no plants to measure, I can start to hear my own thoughts for what feels like years. And what those thoughts had to say really took me by surprise, because what they were saying was, what if I'm wrong? What if all this time I've been wrong? What if I just did not understand what I was reading in those papers? What if I've not analyzed it the proper way? What if I misinterpret everything? And those thoughts were petrifying, because this paper was about to be sent to an international journal. And before publication, it needed to be read by other scientists that are experts in those fields that know certainly much more than me. And then they would send those reviews to my PhD advisor and I, and just expose how wrong I was all this time. And then my PhD advisor would turn back to me and say, "Hey, were you just making things up? I thought you got it. I thought that you know what you were doing. That maybe I was wrong to trust you with that." And what I could also see was just my entire world collapsing, because every people I ever thought about fluorescence or collaborated with would learn from that, and then I would be ostracized by the scientific community. And on that chair, I would just living a complete nightmare with my eyes wide open. And that's And that's when I realized I was just so afraid to be wrong, actually. I was so afraid to be put into question and to put an end to that fantasy. It's fantasy of me being an expert at something. And that was petrifying, honestly. And that's when I realized that I actually needed to be challenged. I needed to be told when I was wrong, even if it's hard to hear. I needed to learn from other people. If I don't put myself into this kind of situation, I would never grow. I would never learn anything. And I would just maintain a vision about myself, a vision that's wrong. And so when I realized that, I closed that document and started writing an email to my PhD advisor saying, hey, here's the paper. I did the best I could based on the literature, but I think it would be good to have another set of eyes on it. What do you think? And then I hit send. And I was still anxious, but I know that that was the right thing to do. I know I would learn a lot, and this made the anxiety easier to bear. Thank you.
That was Anthony DeGrotto. Anthony got his PhD in Belgium, where he studied the impact of the environment, such as high temperature and dry spells, on the vegetation in a grassland. He now works as a postdoc at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Before we continue, I want to remind you that if you would like to learn more about how to tell a science story, check out storycollider.org/education. You can also always follow us on social media for updates and other interesting science storytelling content. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. Find us at Story Collider. And finally, if you're a fan of this podcast, and if you, like us, believe in the power these stories have to reveal the humanity behind science, to change our understanding of how science happens and who it belongs to, please consider donating to the Story Collider at storycollider.org/donate. Also, if you're tired of listening to ads on the podcast, you can always sign up to our Patreon at patreon.com/thestorycollider. Our Patreon supporters receive an ad-free version of this podcast, as well as occasional bonus episodes and other gifts. We're so grateful to everyone who helps make our work possible.
This show is supported by State Farm. Insurance is a part of any solid financial plan. Making sure you have the important things in life covered is one of the best ways to give yourself a little breathing room when things go awry. It's important to protect not only your business, but yourself as a business owner and all current and future team members. State Farm agents know what it takes to run and protect a small business because State Farm agents are all small business owners and they live and work in your community. So they're deeply attuned to what's happening with other small businesses in your market. If you have a small business and are interested in making sure you're protected, reach out to your local State Farm agent to learn more about what you need. They'll help you find the right policy at the right price for your business. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Our second story is from Jessica Brinkworth. It was recorded in her home in the fall this year.
The morning I started my position as an assistant professor, my eyes flew open at 3:30 a.m. and I was filled with anxiety about getting tenure and keeping my job. And so I got up and got right to work on a grant and a paper. And I kept this routine up for years, getting up at 3:30 in the morning and working. And the reason I did this is because faculty jobs are rare. I had landed one and at an intensive research university to study comparative immunology. And I was convinced the department had made a mistake because they should have known that I didn't know what I was doing. And worse, I dragged my family here and we had arrived broke. So I could not lose this job. But I really feared losing this job because I'd been told directly by multiple senior faculty during my PhD that I would never land such a position. I wasn't a serious scientist. I was actually fundamentally unscholarly and the biggest waste of time, according to one of these senior faculty members who had made no secret about how undeserving he thought I was to be a PhD student and had very actively tried to chase me out of the program. So I had arrived at this job knowing I was an imposter. On a July morning, 3 years into this early morning routine, I sat in my usual writing spot, which was a white armchair in my infant's empty, unfinished bedroom. I had my laptop on my lap, coffee in my hand, and I opened up a news site, and I ended up reading news of just truly terrible political cruelty and chaos. And at that moment, I felt completely and totally without agency. And what started as, I can't do anything about this chaos, fired off a cascade of just agencylessness. That guy was right. I'm actually the biggest mistake my program ever made. I don't belong here. I can't do the work. I have no future in this career, to I have let everyone down. And at that moment, after decades of working long hours, 7 days a week, trying to demonstrate that I was actually worthy of a research job, I finally burnt out. And I lay in this chair, my hands are like hanging over the side, and I'm just staring at paint bumps on the ceiling. And I couldn't write. I mean, because what was the point? I had no future in this job. But then, you know, I was up, so I had to do something. And I ended up flipping around Netflix looking for a show that was soothing and found a raft of gardening show episodes. And so, you know, a few days went by and I was still bottomed out, but I was still getting up at 3:30 in the morning. And so each day I made coffee and I opened up a gardening show. And by this point, you know, I'd stopped writing science results altogether. Gardening shows are really interesting because they're really pleasing content. You know, a piece of land is planted with plants and seeds. Shovels make these really pleasant noises cutting into the earth, and things grow. So it's very soothing. And so that's what I did for the rest of the summer. And eventually it was August, and I really needed to get back to writing and writing up classes and, you know, the things that professors do. And so logically, I started watching a documentary about climate change and sustainable agriculture in Illinois, which doesn't have a whole lot of overlap with my job. But, you know, I watched farmers and scientists touching soil and talk about rehabilitating the land and sinking carbon with crops. And a switch was flipped in my head, and I thought, ha, this is my next step. And I felt like this light of inspiration inside of me for the first time in months or maybe years. And so I danced down the stairs that morning for breakfast, and I was yammering away about how I was going to drag my lab program in immunology into environmental stewardship and responsibility. It was a great morning. Because you see, lab science is really wasteful. Low-end estimates are that science labs alone generate 5.5 billion tons of single-use plastics annually. And since I was a graduate student, I've been really uncomfortable with the amount of waste that we were generating in the research I was doing. But you see, serious scientists don't think about these things. Serious scientists make high-impact findings and they get big grants. But I had big findings and grants. And as far as I could tell, I still wasn't considered a serious scientist. And since I wasn't, that morning I thought, okay, well, I'm a PI now. And even if I'm not going to stay in science, I might as well try to do something about the waste that I generate. So when I got to the lab that morning, I was just beaming. I had a purpose. I was supposed to be meeting with one of my undergrad interns, Kyle Bricciardi, to discuss an ethics paper. But by the time he arrived, I was just bouncing with energy about gardens. I know what we're going to do next, I exclaimed. You know, he came into my office. What? We're going to start a goddamn garden. What? Here on campus, we're going to try to offset a little bit of our lab plastic waste and emissions with a garden that sinks carbon. And Kyle was all in. He sat down. We threw ideas back and forth, you know, like a garden that will sink carbon, a garden in a disused, forgotten space. Permission? We don't need permission. We are on a mission. We're going to ask forgiveness. It'll be a renegade garden. And then the logical question came up, you know, hey, do you know how to garden? No, you? No. And I have to admit, I've actually killed a lot of houseplants. So that night, you know, I started to realize how very little I know about gardening, carbon sinks, or even just climate change in general. And I mean, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people in the U.S. that specialize in this research, and many of them have advanced degrees. And I had, what, like 2 hours with a documentary that quoted the Rydell Institute. And then I could hear a little voice in my head, you aren't a serious scientist. You'll lose your job. You'll let everyone down. You are an imposter. And for the first time in years of being bullied in science, I started to push back, albeit just against my little voice. But I really, really want to build this garden. I need this garden because I need something that will make me feel good and pull me out of this dark space. So in the night, staring at the ceiling, I thought, fuck them. This is my foothold to a better space. I thought maybe I could get by with just some plant recommendations. So I reached out to a bunch of scientists that were doing research on carbon sequestration. And a few thought this was a really nice idea, but that the act of growing biomass that would eventually release gases with the intention of reducing gases wouldn't do much to offset anything. And that really brought me down. Like, why hadn't I seen that before? If you grow stuff to sink carbon and that stuff rots, it's going to release gases when it breaks down. So I mentioned the project to a senior faculty member in a research group I attended, and she responded with, I mean, one of the most harrowing things that a scientist can say. Shouldn't you be focused on tenure? Yeah, probably. But I've decided to build a garden. Kyle and I spent a few weeks digging into greenhouse gas generation by households, trying to figure out if the garden could be useful in reducing that kind of waste. And it turns out that rotting food makes the greatest contribution to greenhouse gases in most households. Okay, so we'll compost in it. The garden will be a beard for a trench composting system on campus. And a few weeks later, we had a chance meeting with a colleague in facility and services at the university, and they patched us to the university powers that be that gave us permission, and they patched us to the Student Sustainability Committee who funded it. And so now our garden was no longer renegade. It was an administratively approved garden, and it was going to do something that the campus hadn't been able to do, compost. But we still didn't have any plants. So a few days later, Kyle and I are standing at the prospective site. It's this 70-foot strip of barren earth between the Anthra building and its parking lot. And nothing is growing. No weeds. The ground's really hard. It's like crumbled asphalt and nitrogen-depleted clay. And it's like infested with rusty nails and food trash and old roofing tiles. And it looked completely impervious. Like, what the hell could grow here? And so, you know, I squatted down and I was poking at the ground with my fingers. And I thought, okay, well, what would have grown here? And then it occurred to us, okay, what if we plant the plants that actually belong here, like indigenous plants? Who would be here if we weren't deciding what plants should and shouldn't be on this land? The literature is filled with adaptations that clay-loving plants have made, like sinking nitrogen and hosting fungi that can do that as well. So whoever can do that probably has the best shot in this space. And they would probably also survive our really crappy gardening skills. So we got to work. Laptops open, looking for plants that are native to central Illinois and could survive on the contaminated land around the Anthra building. And that spring, dozens of plants arrived to my office and they were installed in the university greenhouses where the lab members checked on them daily. And pretty soon, little breaks to check on the plants became the best part of my workday. And by this point, I had long stopped getting up at 3:30 in the morning, and it took very little to send me over to the greenhouse to push around little pots. I was just so happy to see these plants grow. So At a faculty meeting right after one of these visits, I was so happy that I excitedly told a room of stunned colleagues that the lab team and I were building a garden to sink carbon and support pollinators. And there is this big, like, almost endless pause. Okay, thank you for that note, Jessica. And then I thought, God damn it! The cat is now totally out of the bag. Now they know I'm not a serious scientist. And so I was so, so down for the rest of that meeting. You could have scraped me off the floor. But then this really funny thing happened. After the meeting, several faculty members approached me and they enthusiastically offered to help me install the plants. And I was shocked. I mean, this isn't what serious scientists do. They don't think about lab waste, they don't like junior faculty making gardens, and they sure as hell don't offer to help install one. And one, Jenny Davis, even saw this greater meaning for the garden. It could help students who have been made to feel uncomfortable in science feel like they belong in a scientific environment. So that when a whole lab puts its hands to earth and thinks about how their actions affect the land that they're on, it makes science more inclusive. And I just couldn't believe it. Other people in my department thought this project was important and it had real life meaning. So that summer, my entire lab and a quarter of the faculty from my department came together and planted the 70-foot, once renegade, now administratively approved and departmentally enjoyed garden. Colleagues stopped by to say hi. They turned on their car lights onto the garden so that we could finish the installation after the sun went down. And my colleague Virginia even threw in some cash. When it came time to initiate the indoor composting, my lab members and my colleagues saved their food scraps in these little itty bitty plastic boxes so that we could put them in the ground behind the plants. And when the microfauna showed up, pictures of butterflies and beetles started flying into my phone from students and faculty. So as the weeks passed that summer, I would write in my office for 25 minutes, and then I would step over to the garden and watch the monarch caterpillars, you know, rhythmically chewing on milkweed leaves, and maybe I'd pull out an invasive plant species or two, or I'd just sit before heading back to my laptop and working on this big backlog of tasks that had accumulated over the last year. Another 25 minutes, I'd be back in the garden for another five, I'd be watching tiny little spiders crawl in and out of anise hyssop blooms or ants fostering aphids. It was so cool. It was like watching the birth of an ecosystem. And I spent hours that summer watching the creatures in that garden. And more often than not, lab members would just pop by to do the same. And once I even found a graduated lab student who's just passing through town sitting there. So as the summer of 2019 wound down, I actually faced some pretty big career disappointments. I had a scooping, there were paper delays and rejections, and I was still nursing exhaustion from this 6 weeks of invited talk travel that past spring where I was home for only 10 days in total. And I wasn't going to have a publication that year. And all of this was weighing pretty heavily on me this one evening when I locked up my office and shuffled down the stairs and sat down on the loading dock that sort of splits this garden. You know, I was waiting for my husband in our car to come and pick me up. It was really, really quiet. And there was this blue light that was spreading across the parking lot. And I was, you know, sitting there worrying about job loss. And but then I shifted my focus. I turned from looking for the car to the plants beside me, and I saw this tiny monarch caterpillar. It was just sitting on the underside of a leaf, and it was maybe a day out of the egg. And I suddenly felt really at peace. You know, my lab and I had tried to take responsibility for our actions. We were trying to do science and steward the space that we work in at the same time. And my colleagues in my department wanted this too. And so, you know, the future kind of just felt lighter. And this caterpillar that I was looking at, you know, it was part of, but it's not the ending of all this growth and support. And so as my car pulled up, you know, I popped the trunk, poured my bags and books into the back, And it struck me, I'm really not a serious scientist. And I'm fine with that.
That was Jessica Brinkworth. Jessica Brinkworth is an assistant professor and evolutionary immunologist in the Department of Anthropology. She directs the Evolutionary Immunology and Genomics Laboratory at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and since the emergence of SARS-CoV-2, her lab has worked with Illinois agricultural workers, focusing on the effects of labor environment on immune function and disease susceptibility. The Story Collider is so grateful to Anthony and Jessica for sharing their stories with us, and the Story Collider is also very grateful for the support of IGB, and as always, the support of Science Sandbox, a Simons Foundation initiative dedicated to engaging everyone with the process of science. This podcast is produced by Aaron Barker, executive director and co-founder of The Story Collider, with help from me, managing producer Misha Gajewski, and senior podcast editor Jen Chen. Special thanks goes out to Story Collider's board and the rest of our staff, including managing director Anne-Marie Lonsdale, science advisory fellow Edith Gonzalez, education director Lily B., and operations manager Lindsay Cooper, without whom none of this would be possible. The stories featured in today's episode were produced by Emma Young and me, Misha Gajewski, respectively. Our theme music is by Ghost, and a huge thanks again to IGB for supporting this episode. Next week, we'll be back with more true personal stories about science from our stages. Until then, thanks for listening.
Thanks to State Farm for supporting this show and helping our listeners protect their businesses and lives. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.